Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Tuesday, October 1st, 2024. Community members and South Sudanese diaspora support flood victims in Lek State.
We set up this committee to raise funds, and we managed to generate 45 million South Sudanese pounds, and we also managed to have $2,000.
And a displaced priest helps families affected by conflict in Sudan.
Our role as clergymen is to help others find housing, food, and water. We give psychological counseling and physical treatment as well. We try to find safe places for them to stay.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Communities in South Sudan's Lek State, Rumbek East County, are mobilizing funds, food, and essential goods to support thousands of families affected by floods. The committee tasked with gathering funds say it has collected millions of South Sudan pounds and $2,500 in just 2 weeks. For VOA News, William Sando Mabor reports from Nairobi.
Nyanwok Molo, Lagos State Minister for Peace, to watch food distributions to families affected by recent flooding in Rumbegis County.
And as the government and people's representative, we came here to witness all this and give the message back to with the concerns. As the Minister of Peace Building, my message is this time is the time they need to unite, the time they need to stand up for each other. If your house is not affected by flood, no matter what happens in the past, you have to forgive each other and stand up for each other. Share the little you have, as God forbid more for you.
Benjamin Makur Mabor is the secretary for the Committee for Mobilizing Funds. He says he thanks God for touching hearts of the diaspora community and other well-wishers who contributed millions of South Sudanese pounds and humanitarian supplies.
As a committee that came up with the initiative to support the communities that are affected by flood in Rumbek East, so we thought, since humanitarian will take a little bit of time to respond, and based on the scarcity of resources in the country, we should also shift in as community to support our own people. And so we set up this committee to raise funds, and we managed to generate 45 million South Sudanese pounds, and we also managed to have $2,000.
He says the committee has purchased food and essential goods, including 500 plastic sheets and over 500 bags of maize flour for families affected by the floods. Madhu Makwaich, government chief whip of Lagos State Assembly, says the situation in Rumbegis County is dire, with the many residents searching for higher ground forced to settle along roadsides.
The situation is really very bad. You can just see on social media, you can check on my social media, or you can check on our WhatsApp group. You will see very terrible photos where the whole house collapsed, the whole compound. If the house is having four or five houses in Tukul in the same compound, they collapse. People are on the road because the road is a bit higher. So that is the situation on ground. Now, whether we are going to continue, yes, we are going to continue. And we are actually asking everybody, whoever think there is a need or there is a responsibility for him to contribute little money, we shall appreciate that money because we need these people to be helped.
Makwaich is calling on the diaspora and the community and the international community to help the flood's victims. Residents whose homes are submerged in water says they have not experienced such devastating flooding for nearly four decades. Last month, the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs highlighted the flooding impact across 38 of South Sudan's 78 counties and the Abyei administrative area. The floods have affected at least 735,000 people and displaced more than 76,000 across the country. For VOA News, I am William Ladmabur, reporting in Nairobi, Kenya.
From Nairobi, we go to Port Sudan, which has been spared from fighting in Sudan's civil war. Churches have become makeshift shelters for many of the country's 11 million displaced residents. In this report, Henry Wilkins visits such church, where a religious leader who is displaced person himself does what he can to help with little support from the international community.
When Sudan's civil war started in April last year, those fleeing the fighting began arriving in the city of Port Sudan. The Church of the Virgin Mary opened its doors to the new arrivals. Basada Bushra Gorgeos is one of the priests at the church.
Our role as clergymen is to help others find housing, food, and water. We give psychological counseling and physical treatment as well. We try to find safe places for them to stay, whether here or outside Port Sudan.
Those who cannot afford to flee the country remain at the church, he says. According to UN figures, almost 11 million are now displaced as a result of Sudan's war. In Port Sudan and its surrounding region, 36,000 are forced to live in public buildings such as churches. Anna Simon Aziz Sadek arrived at the church 2 months ago with her young daughter. She says they were threatened and robbed by members of the paramilitary rapid support forces on their journey here, and that her daughter is traumatized as a result.
When we were coming here, the RSF were stopping cars. They pulled us out of our car and took our belongings. So she's still terrified after she witnessed the gunfire. Now, if she sees a group of strangers, she feels scared.
She says the church was a welcome respite.
Here, we found safety. The church welcomed us and asked us what we needed. We were tired when we came here, but they helped us.
Like Sadek, Gorgeos also found safety in Port Sudan. He was displaced after the church he worked at in another city was attacked by unidentified gunmen. He says the clergymen were deliberately targeted. The attackers knew their names, shot one person in the leg, and looted the building. When he arrived in Port Sudan in October 2023, the trauma weighed heavily on him, he says. But that drove him to help others with similar experiences.
As clergymen, it is a God-given duty and responsibility to serve others, even if we sacrifice our life to do it.
He says the church gets little assistance from the international community. The United Nations has complained about a 50% funding shortfall for Sudan's humanitarian crisis and restricted humanitarian access from the government, exacerbating the plight of Sudan's displaced. On September 25th, the US announced it would send a further $424 million in aid to the country. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Port Sudan, Sudan.
In the United States elections, Vice Presidential candidate J.D. Vance and Tim Walz meet tonight for their first and only debate. VOA correspondent Scott Stans looks at what to expect when the candidates meet in New York.
Go back to San Francisco.
No one's because there.
Tim Walz and J.D. Vance will debate on television for 90 minutes Tuesday with two moderators and no live audience. Vance is a U.S. senator from the Midwest state of Ohio who's running with Donald Trump. He says the debate is a chance to show how Republicans will improve the economy and secure the border.
It's an opportunity for me to get to tell the American people how I think we can make their lives better and how Donald Trump's policies can make them more prosperous, can make the world more peaceful, and can secure that southern border. If we do those things, we're going to win.
Walz is governor of the Midwest state of Minnesota and is running with Kamala Harris. He says Democrats are looking out for working class Americans, unlike his opponent.
Like all regular people I grew up with in the heartland, J.D. studied at Yale, had his career funded by Silicon Valley billionaires, and then wrote a bestseller trashing that community. Come on! That's not what middle America is. And I gotta tell you, I can't wait to debate the guy.
Vance is a one-time Trump critic who won the former president's endorsement for his Senate run. Vance has since aligned himself with Trump's America First approach.
Now, our enemies and a lot of Democrats call us populists, like it's something of an insult. But if being a populist means being on the side of working people rather than the powerful elites who hollowed out our middle class and sent us into stupid foreign wars, then sign me up.
Vance recently told European leaders they need to pay more to help Ukraine fight off the Russian invasion. Walls says Vance and Trump mean to relinquish U.S. leadership.
When Republicans used to talk about freedom, many of them actually meant it. They weren't going to turn their backs on our allies. They weren't going to leave Ukraine to themselves.
Vance says Harris is hurting working Americans in favor of illegal immigrants.
What Kamala Harris seems to want to do is to give all the benefits of American citizenship to people who shouldn't even be here. And that's going to bankrupt this country and make it impossible for normal people to afford to buy a home, to afford to buy groceries, to benefit from that social safety net.
Walls says Trump's career in business and in politics shows he's only looking out for rich people like him.
Rig the economy for those at the top and screw the people at the bottom. That's what they do. Your costs go up. They repeal the Affordable Care Act and bring the things that keeps my mom out of poverty.
Tuesday's matchup is the last scheduled debate before the November 5th election, with early voting already underway in some states. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, the role of the African diaspora in the U.S. elections. That story is coming up right after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. A recent study by the Koinagi Endowment for International Peace show that the United States, Russia, and China are competing for global influence. Amir Hamzawi, director of the Middle East program at the Koinagi Endowment for International Peace, discussed China's influence in North Africa with VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi.
China has emerged in the last decade to become a trade and infrastructure giant. China has become the trading partner number one for, without an exception, all North African countries, coming ahead of the U.S. as well as ahead of different European countries, even when taken together. China has also come to be a key diplomatic partner, calling on North African countries to enter into multilateral organizations headed or backed by China. The BRICS is an example. The Shanghai Security Conference is a second example. China has also actually embarked on deploying military capabilities. China has a military base in Djibouti, which is its first ever military base outside of the mainland. And China has become active in diplomatic mediation efforts with varying degrees of success, be it with regard to the Gaza war, which impacts North Africa, or with regard to the Yemen civil war, in which China mediated between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the Yemen war has had huge impacts on the Horn of Africa and North Africa as well. China is also playing a big role in mediation between different parties in the Sudanese civil war, however, to a very limited success until now. So China has definitely advanced to become a competing great power in the region.
China consistently expanded its economic and diplomatic ties with North Africa and African countries without developing significant military ties. How did this enhance Chinese influence in Africa?
China and North Africa has focused primarily on the trade and the infrastructure part of matters in its bilateral as well as multilateral relations with different countries in the region. China is a big player in Algerian and Egyptian infrastructure projects. China is a big player in Morocco. In different sectors of the green economy in Morocco, China is a big player in solar and wind energy facilities. China is a big player in Tunisia. China has indeed not deployed military capabilities to North Africa. However, China has increased its military arms sales to the region. So its arms sales to Egypt and to Algeria, especially to these two countries, have been on the rise. So China, although it has remained primarily focused on trade, energy, infrastructure, investment opportunities, it has also expanded its portfolio. China is now increasingly becoming a key technology partner for the region as well. So whatever you're finding as Algeria or Egypt difficulties in getting, be it 5G cellular phone networks or different AI tools, or whatever you're finding difficult to get from Western companies, China is always ready to offer at a lower price, sometimes with strings attached.
The study quotes the Arab Barometer public opinion polls, indicating that favorability of China was slightly higher than the favorability of Russia or the United States in North Africa. Can you explain why?
And I believe there are two key factors to explain this phenomenon. Number one, the fact that China is not involved in any active war or any active military conflict in the region, unlike the U.S., which has continued to interfere militarily in different places, not in North Africa, but in regions which are of significance for North African countries, of course, in the Middle East primarily. It's also unlike Russia, which has been actively involved in the Libyan civil war and is indirectly involved in the Sudanese civil war as of now. The second factor explaining it is the fact that diplomatically, China does say what North African publics would like to hear regarding peace mediation to settle the Arab-Israeli or the Arab-Palestinian conflict, regarding nonviolent conflict resolution measures as they pertain to Yemen, Sudan, Libya. The fact that China has advanced to become a power of diplomacy, a power of peaceful mediation, speaks well to Arab publics in North Africa, which have been suffering for a very long time of aftermath of armed conflicts and violent encounters.
That was Amir Hamzawi, director of the Middle East program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA colleague Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. Americans are getting ready to vote November 5th in what promises to be very close presidential race. Like most Americans, members of the African diaspora community face a difficult choice when deciding which direction the country should go. Jeff Squirt spoke with both Trump and Harris supporters to get a sense of their very different life experiences.
A special July 4th celebration for 89-year-old Sylvina Goudes. Today, along with many others from around the globe, she will become an American citizen in a ceremony on the grounds of Mount Vernon, the colonial home of George Washington, the first president of the United States.
I was neither Portuguese nor American, since I have been living here for so many years. So why not be an American citizen? So now my status is settled.
That I will perform work.
Sylvina left her native Portugal almost 20 years ago for the U.S. Like most Americans, she has been following developments in the U.S. presidential election and will be voting for the first time this November.
I follow politics on radio and TV, and I follow the debates. In fact, I followed the last one on Univision. For me, it is important because I learn what they think about their ideas and what they would do.
Iran, Ireland.
As a new U.S. citizen, she feels empathy for those who want to come to the United States.
I think they should come, respecting the laws of the country and the people who live here, so they should come legally.
Sylvina is a Catholic, but when it comes to abortion, she believes in a woman's right to choose.
I think there should be respect for oneself, but sometimes it is necessary because men sometimes don't respect women. There should be more respect for women, but there isn't. So abortion exists, and exists all over the world.
In Portugal, she worked in the social services arena and believes a strong social safety net is important in any country.
Above all, social assistance is important for people of the lower class, especially the ones who have a lot of kids.
When we first spoke with her in July, her impression of former President Trump was that he's too impulsive. She thought President Biden showed calmness and strength. Now that Vice President Harris has entered the race, she thinks she has the profile to be president. She told us she's neither flashy or rude and will be voting for her this November. Other first-time voters we've spoken to intend to vote for Trump, believing he is the right man for the job with the decisive leadership style they feel is necessary for the country. Today, politics is set aside as she celebrates her new citizenship with her family. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Mount Vernon, Virginia.
Washington is trying to keep a Middle East war from snowballing after a dramatic weekend in Lebanon, but regional powers are expressing concerns as Israel's leadership seems determined to continue. President Joe Biden has called for a ceasefire, but VOA's Anita Powell asks, will anyone listen?
Lebanon is on fire after Israel's weekend assassination of Hezbollah's leader, a move that threatens to let loose a wider war in the region. On Monday, President Joe Biden was unequivocal about what needs to happen next.
I'm more aware than you might know, and I'm comfortable with them stopping. We should have a ceasefire now.
But the question is how? How is Washington, Israel's main weapons supplier, going to pull the plug on this violence? VOA asked the White House. Karine Jean-Pierre is White House press secretary.
Our policy has not changed. It just hasn't. It has not changed.
Lebanon's leaders say they have no faith in Israel's intentions. Najib Mikati is Lebanon's caretaker prime minister.
The government is doing everything in its power to confront this destructive, hateful war that Israel is waging against us. And we went to the United Nations looking for a solution. And we met with world leaders. But the enemy went with the intention of treachery and planning more massacres.
And Israel's leader indicated Monday that he is digging in for a fight. Benjamin Netanyahu is Israel's prime minister.
We are at war for our very existence. We will join forces, go hand in hand, and defeat our enemies.
Meanwhile, Washington is joined by other powers in begging for this to stop. Jean-Noël Barrot is France's foreign minister.
Que la guerre se poursuive.
There is still hope, but time is short. I therefore urge Israel to refrain from any ground incursions and to a ceasefire. I call on Hezbollah to do the same and to refrain from any action likely to lead to regional destabilization.
Analysts say Biden and allies have given Netanyahu options to stop the violence by pushing for a 21-day ceasefire in Lebanon and a deal to free hostages held by Hamas in Gaza as a step toward ending that conflict. Gerald Feierstein is director of the Arabian Peninsula Program and distinguished senior fellow for diplomacy at the Middle East Institute.
Well, unfortunately, I would say that the history of their conversations over the past year has been that regardless of what the president's arguments are, regardless of what he has pushed, Benjamin Netanyahu is following his own course and is not responding to U.S. Concerns or advice.
For the people of southern Lebanon and for the region, these are not abstract discussions. This is a matter of life or death. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Still in the United States, former President Jimmy Carter's 100 years birthday comes as authors and historians reevaluate his accomplishments and failures as a one-term U.S. president. VOA's Ken Farabao has more on the legacy of the first presidential centenarian.
When he returned to Plains, Georgia in 1981, former Democratic President Jimmy Carter was defeated, rejected by voters in a landslide election to Republican Ronald Reagan.
In office, he was a political failure, but he was a substantive and visionary success.
Author and historian Jonathan Alter recognizes what many know Carter for today: humanitarian work with his Carter Center, waging peace, fighting disease, and building hope around the world.
He's done terrific work supervising elections in more than 100 countries, but former presidents don't have as much power as presidents. And the list of his accomplishments as president that were ignored or minimized or forgotten entirely was very long.
The Iran hostage crisis, rising inflation, and oil embargoes of the 1970s doomed Carter's White House tenure, casting a long shadow over his legacy. However, Alter's Jimmy Carter biography, His Very Best, is among several that conclude his 4 years in the White House were anything but a failure.
Not just Camp David Accords and opening diplomatic relations with China, but a long string of legislative accomplishments on the environment and many other issues.
Carter signed the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, protecting more than 40.5 million hectares, which Alter says is now considered one of the most important pieces of environmental legislation ever passed.
I think we'll remember President Carter as a president who served in enormously difficult times, who had to deal with circumstances that were far beyond his control.
Joe Crispino, the Jimmy Carter Professor of History at Emory University, says Carter routinely met with his students in Atlanta to discuss the good and bad decisions he made while president.
Putting human rights front and center in American foreign policy, no president had done that in the way that Jimmy Carter had. And it was an important moment in kind of shifting the balance of power in the Cold War.
Crispino says some of Carter's overlooked domestic accomplishments include reorganizing the federal government and deregulating the airline, trucking, and beer industries.
We oftentimes associate a kind of freeing up of the free enterprise economy with the conservative turn that came in with Ronald Reagan, when in fact Jimmy Carter, before Reagan, was already doing a lot of deregulatory work.
Members of Carter's cabinet, including former United Nations Ambassador Andrew Young, are grateful Carter lived long enough to witness kinder interpretations of his legacy.
There's no place in the world I know where people don't have some good things to say about him, whether he succeeded or not.
The world continues to benefit from the Carter Center's work, fighting diseases like guinea worm, which is down to a few cases in Africa and could become only the second disease ever eradicated. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Atlanta.
That's all from us this Tuesday, October 1st, 2024. We now leave you with Musa Juma and the song New Sudan. We've been listening to Musa Juma and the song Sudan Mpya, which means New Sudan. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live program from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Wakilini.